welcome to the IPSE podcast. We are IPSE, the Independent Press Standards Organisation, and this podcast is for anyone who's interested in newspapers, magazines, journalism, press regulation, and of course, IPSE's work. I'm your host, Vicky, and today we have a very special podcast for you. So this is a recording which we recorded live of our outgoing chairman, Sir Alan Moses, being interviewed by the editor of The Mirror, Alison Phillips, at the Law Society last night. So this will be our last podcast before Christmas, and we hope you enjoy, and we will see you again in the new year.
We're here to say goodbye to Sir Alan Moses, who is going to be the outgoing chairman of IPSO, and then to have a conversation about what he feels he has achieved and what he feels have been the highlights and lowlights of his 5 years at the helm. So Alan's going to speak a little bit first, then I'm going to ask him some questions. I think it's important that we have an interesting, robust conversation.
That sounds sinister.
It's always sinister. And then we're going to throw it open to the floor, so hopefully everyone will get an opportunity to ask whatever question that you may wish to ask. So, first of all, over to you, Sarah.
The extraordinary thing about IPSO is that 5 years has seemed, in one sense, like one continuous Groundhog Day, and that is that those who never wanted us to exist have remained still unconvinced about whether we ought to exist and whether there isn't a better model. In contrast to what I believe is the reality of IPSO. And that is in the 5 years when there was nothing to what we have reached today, there has been an enormous and important change. And when people, as invariably Alison's going to ask me, I shall try not to roll my eyes as to what you think you've achieved, what I like to think of is not what I've done or even what Matt, the chief executive, has managed to do, but what IPSO has managed to do. All institutions suffer from becoming institutions. Certainly, IPSO now is sufficiently established to run the danger of being called an institution. But it is dangerous because they are only of any validity because of the people who have worked and continue to work in them. The greatest thing about IPSO is the people who have and who are working there. Quite remarkable in the service that they have given and give every day to the public. What is it? Somebody rings up every 15 minutes. And the way they are dealt with in their distress and in their anger and the sympathy they receive, whether in the end it leads to an upheld complaint or not, seems to me to be an enormous achievement. What they need to appreciate is that whatever you say about the structure, by being there, we have indeed formed that enormously important bridge between those who feel they have not had a voice when faced with the press and the press themselves. What indeed I think has been important about IPSO is engagement. Engaging with the press, engaging with the public, engaging with the legislators. And engagement has worked because daily we have striven to strike a balance that is almost impossible always to get right, but is always worth striving for. And that is the balance between freedom of expression and the regulation and restriction necessary to obey rules to protect the public. And I think that is something of which those who have worked for IPSO over these past 5 years and continue to do so ought to be justly proud. Because we ought never to forget that we are no longer merely a complaints handler. Some of our greatest achievements have been in using the results of those complaints and the engagement with the public and the press during the course of the investigation of those complaints in establishing rules and guidance through our standards operations, through the guidance we have published in relation to all sorts of important and difficult issues, suicide, transgender, the welfare of children, intrusion upon grief and death, and victims of sexual assault, and now our latest guidance due to be published in relation to what is written about the Muslim faith and Islam. If you read, Jonathan Grun is here, much is owed to him, as Secretary of the Editors' Code Committee, the handbook. It is as a vade mecum, as a guide as to what you should think about before you edit a newspaper, the daily newspaper, or you write a piece. The questions you should ask in relation to the difficult issues under the Code of Conduct. That seems to me, written as it was with the assistance of those who work with IPSO, a remarkable achievement gathered together with the guidance that we publish. This important question, and if people ask me, well, how has the press changed? It is in the realization and acknowledgement within the newsrooms of the questions they need to ask themselves in order to strive for compliance with the editor's code, the rules they have set themselves. That questioning that won't always lead, and will sometimes frequently not lead, to articles that do other than outrage and from time to time cause offence. But what we have to ask ourselves is whether that is or is not a necessary price to pay for an unlicensed, unruly press. What I have learnt in the past 5 years is that that which most arouses our critics, namely a process of self-regulation, is actually vital to preserve the freedom of the press. Really, the far greater problems of journalism and newspapers are twofold. The absence of any curated or editorialized news at all, as we see on the internet, or the most secure system of making the press behave in a way our rulers want to, namely a licensing system that bans and forbids what is published. I believe there's a 99% satisfaction rate with journalism in China, and I don't believe it's far off in Iran either. You can have a system that bans through licensing, that says you shan't publish something in the daily newspaper unless you comply with the rules that we set you. It's not difficult to do, either on the web or in the printed media. But I don't believe that the cost is worth the candle. I think we would all suffer as a result of that. And so in a way, in answer possibly to the question you're going to ask me, I think that perhaps IPSO has prevented far worse and far more dangerous things happening to press as a result of what we have tried to do, both for their benefit and for the benefit of the public. So thank you all of those who have supported us. I have little doubt that there'll be questions tonight by those who not only don't agree with me, but have never felt that we are worthy of support. And I'm always happy to see them here, and I shall try to bear their criticism with as good a grace as I can.
Thank you. Well, I think you did a good job there to try and upset my question. I'll carry on regardless. So 5 years ago, it was like a different country. IPSO was launched with the boast that it would be the toughest press regulator in the free world. Meanwhile, its opponents at that time called it a sham regulator. Which is it?
Neither. Simply not possible to identify whether it's the toughest regulator in the world. I think when you compare us with, we were told, why didn't we have an Irish model? In fact, the Irish model is a poor one. It's a real problems about people daring to write about some of the worst, as it were, under the table crime arising out of the Emerald Revolution. There, Australia really is a far milder system. Of course, there are tougher regulators, as I said, in China and in Iran. In certain respects, in relation to the web in Germany, they have done more. The one thing it's not, though, is a sham. It's quite impossible to level that accusation with any sense of accuracy or avoiding clause one of the editor's code distortion. And it is so interesting how the very thing that our critics most condemn in the press are things that from time to time they devalue their own criticism by being guilty of them themselves. You simply can't listen to our day-to-day discourse with the public and what we do to help them, or with the challenges that we face from internally from the press legal departments and standards departments daily. Highly sophisticated departments that dislike and disapprove and resist vigorously what we propose and indeed when we reach our rulings. And they take those very seriously. But the idea that the guidance we produce, the standards that we have drafted and prepared as a result of our experience over the years of our complaints is somehow unreal or pretense, it is simply untrue.
But there, in your opening speech, you said that you get 15, a phone call every 15 minutes or something. So there's still a considerable number of people in this country are feeling wronged in some way by the press.
Absolutely.
So have you done enough to change the behaviour?
We've never done enough. I mean, it would be absurd to claim that we've done enough. And regulatory work in the context of the press must always surely be work in progress. And there was always more to do. One of the things that we most dislike in our press is the sort of challenging bullying. The way that they will pick on a target, usually somebody they've built up one day, and he docked Beaverbrook's Beaverbrook's message when asked the secret of his success, and said, well, we build them up one day and we'll kick them the next. And that is a trend that we see. There are other things that we dislike, many of us, that we read daily in the newspaper. But what are we going to have a rule that says you're not to bully? Are we going to have a rule, and this is one of the deep questions questions that we're daily asking ourselves and grappling with the IPSA. Are we going to have a rule that says the press shall not offend? Are we going to have a rule that says the press must be tasteful, balanced, decent, fair? All of us, I think, would probably answer, yes, please. Why haven't we got it? You could have a rule, if you want all our newspapers to sound like the BBC, because they have those rules as a licensed public broadcaster. They don't always comply with them, and their idea of balance is a pretty curious one. But nevertheless, you could strive to have all those rules, but I simply do not think that that would be an acceptable way of running the printed media because of what you would lose. From time to time, that ability, and it won't be those who attack the press will say it's not often enough, and that may be true, but from time to time, you will have really important things that emerge from newspapers that feel they're not restricted by the obligation to be fair or unbiased.
But what proportion of people who come to you with a feeling they've been wronged leave without any resolution that they're happy with?
Well, actually, every one of those whose complaint is rejected. The trouble is that the greatest proportion of the complaints that we get don't come within the remit of the editor's code.
And that's often led to the criticism, isn't it? That people feel that there still isn't a place for them to take.
There's a complaint. I mean, if you look at our satisfaction levels when you ask the question before the result of their complaint, they are enormously high. We get enormous praise in the way that we treat them during that process of investigation. Of course, you ask them when they then say, back to your complaint is not being upheld, or it's not within the jurisdiction of IPSO. Well, then, of course, they will, what's the point of all this?
But that is a point that people always come back to, the editor's code, and what isn't within the jurisdiction. What's your view on the editor's code in its current state, and would you that could be any improvements that you
make? Again, there are always improvements in drafting. I think the good things about it, if I can not answer your question, let me acknowledge that I'm not answering it fully, but I'm leading up to it. I promise I'll try to answer it. I mean, the good things are that it is quite short, and it covers, I believe, the most important topics, and it is sufficiently broadly drafted that it will cover events, stories, complaints that you can't foresee. The moment you make it more restrictive, the moment you give the definition, you put it in a straitjacket. I think that's very dangerous. I think a certain flexibility. So generally, I do believe it covers the most important aspects. But I go back to what I said before. I think some of the things people most dislike about what they read, particularly about themselves in the press, are something we couldn't have rules about. Let me give an example. I think one of the real vices of the way we talk about each other and the way we write about each other in the press is generalization. The moment you say, you people all whatever, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Jews or Roman Catholics or Muslims or women or transgender. The moment you describe a group and attribute characteristics to that group, you're usually descending into probably offensive idiocy.
Does that take you to clause 12?
And I think that, which was going to lead me, then you come to this enormous difficulty, which has been the greatest difficulty from which IPSO has had to grapple with, and we are, to our credit, grappling with it, it is clause 12, which is, I think most people here will know what I'm talking about discrimination. which in one way, as Ben there used to work for sentiment, it's a very old concept in the context of writing about things. I mean, I can say I can discriminate against you in the way I talk to you, in the way I treat you at work, or even in other social contexts. But in the way you write, then it becomes more difficult. So it requires a definition, and it is writing in a pejorative way about an individual, for example, their faith, or their gender, or their ethnicity. And I think almost the biggest criticism we get is, why won't you have the same rule about a group? Why is it not also true that if you write about the Irish, the Muslim faith, the Roman Catholic faith, why, if you write pejorative things about that, shouldn't that be breached the editor's code? So after all, that is likely to be what upsets most individuals.
Yes, and why shouldn't it?
Because, in my view, you have to strike a balance between allowing the press to write critically and pejoratively about a religious group, for example, rather than banning it. Because there is no right not to be offended, both under the law and under the regulations in this country. It's a very difficult proposition to accept, and it's a very difficult proposition to argue in favour of. To say, I have a right to offend you to another human.
How do you make that argument then? If you're saying you haven't got a right to offend the individual, but you have got a right to offend
the group. The way I justify it, and I acknowledge that it is difficult, the way I justify it is that a balance has to be struck. You really to say that I cannot write rude things about the Roman Catholic Church, who for generations has allowed and overlooked the way priests deal children. And it may well not be the priest's fault, it may be the fault of the institution. You send children away at the age of 9 to a seminary, for example. Am I not to? That would be deeply offensive to write about to those of that particular faith. And I can think of lots of other examples in relation to other faiths as well. Are we going to have a rule that says you're not allowed?
But do you think that the current situation with Boris Rock is imperfect in itself, and there might be some middle ground to be reached?
I'm sure that it needs to, and those who are here on the editor's code, Jonathan will know that it is something I have spoken about, and indeed I'm going to be speaking again about next week. Two things IPSO has done. There are three important things. We're about to produce guidance in relation to writing about Muslims.
Yes.
People say, well, why pick on their means? Because I believe that that's something that has caused great upset. We have had constant conversations, and I do with the Muslim Council and others in Mikdad Basti, who we see regularly. And so we started with that, but we hope that will sort of happen with other governments we do. And we are at IPSO launching an inquiry into Clause 12, and as to how, in a neutral way, we haven't come to any decisions. I have personal views about it, which a lot of other people don't agree. But in looking into whether something might be done. But I remember right at the outset, with Jonathan Hayward from Impress, we were both talking about the same things. Clause 12 is going to prove the greatest difficulty, because even the blessed, sanctified Impress themselves have found enormous difficulty in drafting, although they were actually going to apply it amongst their hypothesis, I don't know, in drafting clauses. Because one of the real problems is we all know that if you write something offensive, it can be dangerous, because those who wish to stir up racial hate will use that material as the baseline on which to build. And I'm very conscious of that danger. And
it's and we clear, have had examples of that over the last 5 years.
Much longer than 5 years. Certainly during my tenure, and indeed.
And have you felt frustrated at times that there have been cases that you don't fall within your jurisdiction, which you felt that perhaps you would have liked to have some.
Oh, deeply. Absolutely
you,
right.
Is there anything that you should share with people that you felt?
No. And I'll tell you, I mean, one of the really important things that I have been religious, I hope, in doing, and that is that I'm chairman of the complaints committee, in other words, as well as being chairman of the board. And it's simply, I have to represent the views that the complaints committee have reached. And I can tell you that there have been decisions where we have not upheld the complaint, where we have been deeply, deeply unhappy about disapproving of what has been written. And one of the real things that a regulator, an ipso, suffers from is the sense that when we have not upheld the complaint, it looks as though we're endorsing what has been written.
Yes.
And it's simply untrue. A moment's thought teaches you it's untrue. It's certainly the appearance is given. And we try to write, particularly more recently in our decision, trying to give a glimpse,
yes.
A glimpse of what, although not, one of the things is, I mean, I've written to so often, well, why don't you speak out? You've seen the headline in the Daily Mirror today, it's absolutely repulsive. How do you, why don't you say something? And of course, I would love to, I mean, daily is something I'd like to say of what, of how much I disapprove of that, what you've written. About Holly, was it about the missile? It's about office parties.
Yeah.
It mustn't be about reading or asking questions. But it's not, I mean, I wanted to, and I was terribly tempted, but waving my stick, beating the wind, doesn't do any good. It's not the regulator's job. But it causes us great distress, and you know the sort of stories that has led to our considerable
particularly in comments pages, which obviously are our comments pages, but that's where we've seen some sort of quite unpleasant things.
I think quite unpleasant, putting it very much.
Yeah.
I mean, I with Katie Hopkins, I mean, that's the cockroaches. Now, I thought that was a criminal offence, and we did report it, but I mean, please do nothing about it, and I'm not wholly surprised.
Is that really fair to expect the police to turn up and do something about something?
Well, I think that was an incitement to racial hate.
But then this brings us back to the point that if you've got police that have already, like, can't report on the murders in this country, they're learning nothing else. Where we've got a press
there's a terrible story.
A press regulator. Shouldn't that really fall to you? Surely somebody's going to grab hold of that.
Well, I mean, I think that's a very fair point, and I'm sure that is one of the things that our investigation, Clause 12, will look at. Hmm.
So. Let's talk about the independence of IPSO. Isn't it the harsh reality in all the world still that he who paid Piper paid the tune?
Well, I think the real problem about cliches is that you start thinking cliche. I'm very sorry about that it's completely untrue. One of the things you have to ask yourselves is what other source of money would you rather have? Paying for a regulated area. Are we really to be dependent upon government for the resources by virtue of a contract that goes over the whole span of the 5 years of the life of the contract? Matt and others achieved that, Matt T.I., the chief executive, achieved that quite early on in the life of IPSO. So we weren't getting cap in hand each year. And that has happened. And we now have another 5-year contract, and that's so that we have a discussion. Here's the budget that we think we need, a discussion with the those that represent the press, our members through the regulatory funding company, and then an agreement. And it's simply difficult to see any other acceptable way of financing us. And the idea that through that they can exercise any control is, I was told not to say bollocks to is below. Yes.
But, okay then, so you say that bollocks, but how do we get, and I think there is, if that's the case, how do you get people to believe it? So one of the big conversations I've got isn't necessarily what it's actually done, what it's actually achieved, but it's getting people to believe it. It's a PR job.
It's more than a PR job, because that sounds sort of diminishing it. And I think you've identified that the thing we've been worst at, and that is the ability to persuade those. We haven't persuaded great sections of the legislature,
yes.
Particularly, we need only read the manifesto of the Labour Party and the Lib Dem manifesto. And we haven't persuaded them. I spent a lot of time both in the Lords and in the Commons and speaking. And when you speak to people individually, you do, but you don't as a...
Why do you think that is?
Because I think partly a very successful glossy magazine produced by Hacklof with the sort of headlines that often go back to before Ipsum ever existed have continued to be. I mean, if you're an MP, you're working so hard on behalf of everyone nowadays, you pretty much, I've watched them do it as they come to meet me. They're going like that through their iPad or their pieces of paper. You really, Dave, you're so hard working, your brain won't absorb more than a few, three or four lines of headlines. The latest
and the
thing that you've been handed.
And the press has a long way to come back from. Well,
and the press, you identify something that is, I keep saying to you, but why should you listen to me? You're very bad at selling yourselves. You're incredibly bad at explaining your importance or the good things you do.
We are trying to get better at that.
And you did get, what was really interesting was the coming together of the local newspapers and the national newspapers in relation to Section 40. Mm. But they were doing very little about that after an excruciating evening in Carlisle, where the water tasted, because they'd had terrible floods, and we all sat around, and I can't tell you how. I couldn't bear it any longer, and Matt said, you're not ready to say anything. So that was really bad. So I stood up and I spoke about Section 40, which I thought was inimical to a successful regulation. But what was interesting to pick up your point was that it galvanised both local, who after all weren't concerned, weren't defenders of national press, into understanding how they had to do something to persuade not only MPs, but the public as to the importance of their existence. Mm.
So moving on now, but there's two questions that are sort of similar but different. So have press standards improved over the last 5 years? And also, have press got better at self-regulation? Or, as I suspect, there are perhaps other things at play which have improved press standards?
I'm sure that you're right with other things, but I think what Ipso has really importantly and significantly achieved, and that is to make internally, newspapers take the whole issue of compliance far more seriously than they had before. I mean, the training that we go out both in the local and in the national press that we have done over the past 5 years, the systems they have set up to consider whether how they avoid being breached, and as you will know, the enormous dislike editors and journalists have of losing back of complaints. I mean, they really resent us going in there saying, you've got it wrong, you shouldn't have done that. And that attitude and their dislike of having corrections or adjudications printed in their newspaper, what they Their newspaper is something that I think they have taken far more seriously because I wasn't there.
But looking at what you find now moving forward to what you found 5 years ago, do you sense the attitude towards self-regulation has changed within the newsgroup?
I sense they take it much more seriously. I think there are certain things that they themselves have, two things that I think they take, to those who are victims of it, they won't believe this, but privacy, I think they take more seriously. I think gratuitous intrusion on privacy. They certainly take things like suicide more seriously, writing about that, and intrusion on guilt, on grief more seriously. And I also think that one big change has been the speed with which they're prepared to consider complaints. I mean, the only, so I was told, I wasn't around, but the thing of the journalist putting the complaint or the letter in a drawer and it going away, they really have begun to understand that speed can be very important.
I mean, I feel, from my perspective, that things, it's changed enormously. That sort of self-analysis all the time is there.
It's very interesting when we had, I think the Daily Mirror, it was some sting on an MP very early on.
I remember point out that wasn't a sting. That was not a sting.
Exactly.
It really wasn't.
But the really interesting thing was there I was sort of, we got a lot of custom on our face almost entirely my fault. Because I was at some Tory Party conference, I was saying, oh,
yes,
we're going
to sort
that
out.
The chap himself didn't want to complain for very good reasons. We said, well, we'll take it as a third party complaint, stand this out. And I remember there was a chap from Canton and Cathcart saying, there you are, press behaving, disgraceful. He hadn't even seen the papers. So talk about rush to judgment. And of course, we ended up because two things I wanted to say. One, the extraordinary thing in the newspapers, unfortunately, you're here, so you'll hear this praise. They actually had documented the stages they'd gone through to ensure that they were complying with the rules in relation to investigation.
Yes.
And all of which was documented, shown meetings with the editors, timings, and so on. And then, of course, when we didn't uphold the complaint, it just made it worse for the poor victim.
But what was interesting about that, and I think it does relate, is that was a MP who took pictures of bits and pieces to women, and he was actually involved in this group to get more women into politics, which obviously one way of going about it. But what was interesting was that through the whole Me Too movement. So and then everyone thought, that's outrageous, the tabloids, it's like, the poor man's only taking pictures of cops or women. Whereas obviously 2 years later we had Me Too, and then that would have been rather political thing. Which I think takes me back to that point that we've seen huge societal changes in the last 5 years. And there's been things we've seen recently. We had
Ben Stokes is very interesting, and you make a good point. It's not sure, Ipso can't take credit for that. I mean, I think it's part of a process in which we join. But you see, I think the newspapers had enormous readers were deeply offended by it, and they got enormous kickback and resistance from their readership. They lost their readers who were not with them and didn't think they should have published that story. And the same thing happened with Kelvin McKenzie.
Yes, absolutely.
The story with the footballer, the Norwich footballer, a disgraceful piece was written that cost him his job. But it was the readers immediately that day and the next writing
media
into
has changed that as well.
And of course,
I do wonder that self-regulation is a thing now because everyone's very mindful of the impact across the board of doing things that aren't right. But I want to move on to a slightly different thing in that when Ipso was created, it was also, as we discussed, created in a very different time where perhaps everyone felt that maybe free speech in this country was something maybe that everyone was taking for granted. Do you feel that actually a lot of the rulings around it have been vindicated by perhaps we now see more threats to our free speech?
I think that's one of the things that IPSO has demonstrated has been really worthwhile, and that is that however much people are offended and disapprove of what appears from time to time, as I say, quite often write about what's in the press, what we fear, the risk of losing, of damage to that freedom, is far greater than the disadvantages of having it. And the big issue is the maintenance of the importance of the freedom in the context of people saying, well, you've got to think of all the online harm, think of how we've got to control it through algorithms, which is going to do great damage to the press. So that you find a cause, how do you stop the online harm due to publicity about suicide or paedophilia? How do you stop that at the same time as preserving freedom of communication and the press? You see, the really interesting example is the white paper on online harm. I don't think anybody would seriously dispute the objective that that paper is seeking to achieve, but it is curiously light on the method of achieving it, and which is the real problem grappling with. And I foresee for Edward in the next 5 years and the rest of you, the real problem is how it's going to be how to preserve freedom rather than how to restrict it. Not funnily enough, I mean, you managed to avoid talking about the holiness we read daily in the Guardian, the sanctimony. And then
the
sanctimony. Yeah. Oh, of course it is. My son works for it. How their response to the Home Affairs Select Committee when newspapers are on writing about race issues is really worth reading, because it talks about, it says, let's get away from talking about stopping things and banning. What we really need to do is to write more, is to encourage people to say more, to point out the stupidity and ignorance and danger of generalizations about people's faith and about their ethnic background. And I think that that's a really important message that I think we have to hang on to, because the real issue with journalism is places like Malta.
Yeah. We talked briefly there about the digital world. I mean, there is an argument that really Ipso is sort of worrying about the side of painting the line white, while meanwhile you've got a massive great brawl going on in the middle of the pitch, because we've got this wild west of the digital world where people say and do all sorts of things. We've also got a global issue when really Ipso can only really look after this one little small island. So, is it going to become increasingly irrelevant with the growth of digital and the growth of a digital, a global?
No, I think it becomes more relevant. Completely the opposite. I think that the public are learning the importance of being able to look to a source on which they can rely. And we see it, I agree with Ipsa, in the sort of fact-checking organisations, trusts, someone who on our complaints board works or did work for one of these really important trusts that encourage resources where you can go and look at checking of facts daily, as the BBC tried to do. It's interesting, some of the newspapers are doing daily during this election. And by having a regulator and by belonging to a regulator, you are at least having some sort of kite mark or benchmark that you need to be educating the readers to look for. But at least you see, you have an editorialized, what I call a curated source of news and opinion. And of course we hate when we read something that we don't agree with, and we like it, don't we? Like, but at least it is there, somebody like you in your story in the Sunday Mirror, that we know there'll be somebody there who has thought about this and has asked themselves the question, is that what I'm going to put in my newspaper tomorrow?
But it is a worry, the amount of news that has been traded digitally that has no regulation around it.
Absolutely. If I was writing a newspaper, I would, in a sense, I'd say, why are you regulating us at all when you're letting vast amounts of what you read from the newspaper, you read in exactly the same form, story that has been flipped across the screen on your phone. And in those circumstances, who's regulated? Has it been a public broadcasting regulator, the BBC? Is it IPSO? Is it not regulated? I mean, it is a very difficult issue, but it seems to me that it is really necessary to have a section of the media that can distinguish itself from flatulence everywhere.
So your thoughts on the future, like your successor. Just a couple of specific things. Do you think that there should be an attempt to bring on board other national titles, the FT, Guardian? Or do you think that's just
never? No, I mean, I hope I'll be proved wrong tomorrow. I don't think it'll happen. Guardian, as I say, reaches a standard of piety that has hitherto not let it felt be able to join with the rest of you and muddy its board. I mean, it's very sad. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time with Russ Bridger when we started, of whom I'm a great admirer. And he said, well, if you do these 10 things that he actually wrote out, we'll join you. And he did them. Then he was no longer there. And I mean, they simply didn't, I mean, the original, but they didn't want to be associated with the rest of you. And I think we've convinced quite a lot of people that, I mean, it's a shame because I do believe, like the rest of you, they believe in journalism. They really regard newspapers, whether in an online form or not, as of great significance and importance. And I think it's therefore sad why they don't want to, even if they disagree with us and disagree with you, why they don't want to join in improving what we do. It seems to me to be a curiously incoherent reason, but not, well, and I don't know what that reason is about, not joining us. The FT had never regarded themselves as a national newspaper, and actually, of course, their rules are much stricter than any rules that would normally apply. And then, as for the Evening Standard, well, I better not say. I can see I'm being forbidden to say my
name. And a final question. Do you think your successor's job will be easier than yours has been? In that, because you were there from the very because you were there from the very beginning, your every success and every failure has been very much caught up with people's desire for you to succeed or fail. Whereas maybe he can come into it and maybe some of the opposition is fading.
I don't think, I don't detect that the opposition is failing. It's probably by a reason that, I mean, the problem with advocacy is that if it's repetitious, it starts to sound like the bellman in Star Hunting the Stars. What I say three times must be true. There's a certain sort of monotonous bleat that starts stopping you listening, but or reading. But it will still go on, and I think criticism is a good thing. I just object to the baseline of it sometimes isn't accurate. But then who are we to complain about inaccuracy? But I think it will go on. I think there will be enormous continuing criticism from the legislature. But the one thing I'm really confident is that you have a balanced, wise, sensible, not hysterical, whatever emotional show. I think there will be enormous, bigger success than there's been hitherto.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much indeed. Thank you.